This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Minimum wage was all the rage, both in D.C., where the governors met, and in Hartford, where the labor secretary gave it a push. The feds set up shop at the Capitol. Keno is dead, but nobody's claiming they ever thought it should live. And we've got a new state senator in New Haven. Just a few of the subjects that we will tackle on today's Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266 with your thoughts about the news of the week. You can always join us online at WNPR.org. Joining us, as always, on the show, in our studio, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Good to be here.
Christine Stewart is editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And also Matt Dorenzo, who's group editor for Digital First Media in Connecticut. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
Joining us by phone today is our special guest, Ken Rudin, the political junkie, who's been heard for so many years on NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's now got his new website, kenrudinpolitics.com, and he's got a podcast of The Political Junkie, which is heard each week. You can find out more at kenrudinpolitics.com. Good to talk to you once again, Ken.
Good morning, John.
So, first of all, I want to start with all the things that happened around the minimum wage. The most interesting thing to us, actually, had to do with Governor Daniel Malloy and a little dust-up that he had in D.C. at the governor's meeting with Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. First of all, let's listen to a little bit of an exchange from that day.
I think there are things we can do instead of waving the white flag of surrender, instead of declaring this economy to be a minimum wage economy. I think America can do better.
I don't know what the heck was a reference to white flag when it comes to people making $404 a week. I mean, that's the most insane statement I've ever heard, quite frankly. Let's be very clear that we've had a great meeting and we didn't go down that road and it just started again and we didn't start it. Thank you.
Okay, so first, that's Bobby Jindal, the Louisiana governor. In case you don't remember him, he's the guy who once thought he might be a presidential candidate, and then he decided to give the response to President Obama in 2009 after his State of the Union address, and it seemed to not go very well for him after that. And then, of course, Governor Malloy speaking to him. Ken, this was in D.C. at this governor's conference. Supposedly, they were all getting along, and a lot of the governors are saying a higher minimum wage, not such a bad idea. I mean, should we make anything of this little partisan battle at the end of what's maybe otherwise a more successful meeting?
Well, it's gotten a lot of a national attention, and maybe we should make something of it, because the argument all along was that Congress, you know, Congress is just stuck in partisanship and recrimination, and nothing is getting worked. But at least we have the National Governors Association that'll rise above partisanship. So to hear Bobby Jindal, then Governor Malloy, come out afterwards and go back and forth regarding partisanship did shock a lot of people, got a lot of national attention. But clearly, Bobby Jindal and the Republicans were ready for a fight, preparing for a fight. President Obama attacked the Republican governors during a Democratic governor fundraiser on Thursday, and so Republicans were expecting to be lectured. And I think just that the anger and hostility emanating from Bobby Jindal, who still is ostensibly talking or thinking about a 2016 presidential run, it just was too much for Jindal.
This minimum wage fight that, of course, came to Connecticut, we'll talk about in just a little bit with the labor secretary coming here, something that President Obama started by proposing a $10.10 minimum wage. Then Governor Malloy and others have somewhat gotten on the bandwagon and saying that states should back a higher minimum wage. Is this something, Ken, that's playing well in red and blue states? Is there support from governors of all stripes?
No. I mean, the Republican argument has long been that a higher minimum wage is a job killer. It hurts small businesses. Whereas Democrats, who would love to not have to talk about the Affordable Care Act 24/7, they say, look, there are a lot of things that the country is screaming for, calling out, crying out for, and that includes not only extending unemployment insurance benefits, but an immigration overhaul, but of course increasing the minimum wage, and you're seeing a lot of action in a lot of states run by Democratic governors.
But it polls exceptionally well amongst Republicans and Democrats. At the end of the day, it seems as though a majority of people in America would like to see something happen with a minimum wage.
That's absolutely true, and then you're absolutely right about majorities of Republican voters as well. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or depends on where your perspective is, but the Republicans would love to not expose any divisions inside Republican ranks. They'd rather focus on Obamacare and say, oh, look, when we recapture the Senate in 2014, which is very iffy or it's problematic. But once we have the Senate and the House, then in 2015 we'll talk about a broader national agenda. But for right now, let's not expose divisions in our ranks. Let's just focus on the Affordable Care Act.
We'll get back to some more of the policy, but it's much more fun, I think, for us to talk about what we saw on television. Colin, what did you make of Bobby Jindal and Governor Malloy getting into it?
Well, you know, I think the round goes to Malloy. I mean, everybody's very tired, obviously, of mindless, knee-jerk partisanship. And the question for Malloy is, how do you object to it without becoming it and exemplifying it? I'm not sure he entirely threaded that needle. And in some ways, I think he's kind of emerging. Whalers fans will remember Nick Fodiu and various other guys who weren't really good skaters necessarily and weren't really good puck handlers. But when it came time to drop the gloves and brawl, they were ready to do it. And Malloy's kind of that guy in some ways. And it took him about 2 seconds to go into what Cesar Millan calls the red zone. I think Democrats are probably pretty happy about that. They're pretty happy that there's a guy who can do that. So, A, they don't have to say that stuff. He could have done it more elegantly. But, you know, I don't know. I was at the gym last night. I looked up. There he was with Chris Matthews. So, as Ken says, it's getting a certain amount of attention anyway.
Paz?
He's kind of that guy. this is the governor whom, by his own description, is the governor of the sharp elbows. He's real quick. To continue with Colin's hockey analogy, he's the guy who loves digging in the corner, elbows high, and periodically he comes to the attention of the national folks on cable who love this stuff. One of his first appearances on Morning Joe, he gave some pretty good body blows to both Chris Christie and Mitt Romney. This is part of that collection of Dan Malloy highlights.
The Dan Malloy highlight reel.
I guess for people who haven't seen it, I mean, he's actually, you can see him have this visceral reaction to what, Governor Jindal said. And he's itching his head and he's scratching his head and he was anxious to jump in there.
It's like Sean Penn, when somebody would be hitting on Madonna. It didn't take him long to figure out what to do about it.
Well, clearly Governor Jindal's statement was a calculated political thing, and this is a guy who's deeply unpopular in Louisiana, and Louisiana Republicans don't even think he should run for president. Whereas anyone trying to read anything into Malloy being a surrogate for President Obama, I don't think it was calculated. I think he just grabbed the microphone.
As Christine said, you can actually see him wanting to get in front of the microphone and doing that. Ken, for us though, people are always thinking about calculations here. What is, aside from us smiling a bit when the governor goes on Morning Joe or something, what is Governor Daniel Malloy's profile outside of our state?
Well, he's no Jody Rell, let's put it that way. I think the problem is that he knows his numbers are not great in Connecticut. He knows he had the tax increase did not serve him well, even though it may have helped his agenda, but it didn't help his numbers. But he is, as you guys are saying, he is a scrapper. He keeps saying that, look, I don't want to talk about politics. There's so many other things to talk about. I'm not talking about politics. But he loves to tweak the Republican Party. He loves to point out the divisions in the Republican Party, either at home in Connecticut or nationally. And you could see, if you looked at the video, you could just see him, as you guys are saying, he was just itching for a response. And everybody knew that Bobby Jindal was going to say something because he had been saying something to journalists for the last couple of days before that post, that outside White House outburst. So Malloy is a scrapper. He's a fighter. You know that you're going to, speaking of a different sport, you're going to get into the ring and you're going to get pummeled, not knowing who's going to win by knockout or by decision. But he was ready for that fight.
But over the weekend, Colin, another one of these big public appearances, we had heard a couple of days before we got a call in our studio from CNN saying that the governor was going to go on with Candy Crowley, and they were looking for any sort of information they could get on the governor. And then they of course, spent maybe about 30 seconds with each of four of them. But one of the things that he did get out is that he's not going to be a candidate for president in 2016. Colin, do you think that in some ways Governor Malloy is trying through his trips to Washington, through some of these visible television appearances, through even just getting into the ring with Bobby Jindal, that he's trying to raise his national profile? Or is it just really a guy who can't help himself and has to talk?
Yeah, first of all, the noise you heard over the weekend was that big sigh of relief that Hillary Clinton was breathing. I do think in some ways some of the things that we're talking about, some of the pugnacity that we're talking about, it may play better at a national level than it does on a local level. In Connecticut, first of all, this isn't really a gloves-off, bare-knuckle kind of political environment for the most part. I don't think it really goes over all that well. And I mean, if you think of sort of the really number of vicious attack ads and stuff that have been run over the years, probably proportionately less than in a lot of other states. But at the national level, where they kind of maybe do need an enforcer, maybe they do need somebody to do the tough jobs, this may go over pretty well. And so, you know, who knows what he's angling for, or even if he knows what he's angling for. But I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of behavior were rewarded somehow, somewhere down the line.
I think he's angling for love, affection, and a boatload of money from the Democratic Governors Association. You know, he wants the support of President Obama in a lot of states. Presidential endorsement in a gubernatorial race doesn't help a whole lot. In Connecticut, it does. I mean, you know, Obama won double digits here. So Malloy's reelection plan includes having a lot of, I think, air cover from national Democrats.
Any other thoughts on Malloy's political chances nationally moving forward?
Well, I wonder, picking these fights, you know, when he stood up against Rick Perry, who came to Connecticut to try to push, you know, companies to move out, I think that went over well in Connecticut for him to pick those fights. I don't know if these fights that aren't Connecticut's fights help him.
I think it helps with the base. The minimum wage issue by itself is, to use that tired phrase, it is a red meat Democratic base issue in here. And, you know, Malloy's been slow to that issue. There was some, I think suspicion is too strong a word, but there was some discomfort among the left in Connecticut. And now, you know, you got Malloy, who's pushing a 10-10 minimum wage, who pushed paid sick days. You know, now I think he's their guy. I mean, they're feeling a little bit more enthusiastic about him in a time when elements of labor, notably teachers, are less than enthusiastic.
Well, and this is one of the funny things, Christine, is, you know, I talked with him about this the last time he was on the show. He was supportive of a $9 minimum wage. He thought 10 was way too far. And then I asked him about his new plan. He's like, yeah, I was for that all the time. I mean, he gets pugnacious about that. He really seems to want to buy all into this idea that Connecticut should lead the pack when it comes to the minimum wage.
You know, he says that, but, you know, it was just a year ago that he was kind of hands off. You know, let's let the federal government raise the minimum wage and let's not do anything. I mean, he did sign the increase into law, but not, you know, not 10-10.
Well, he signed an increase then because he needed to. I don't think he wanted to run for re-election as the first Democrat in, you know, 30 years to stand for re-election without having raised the minimum wage. And that's what it would have been if he didn't go for that last year.
Ken Rudin?
I'm just going to say, if there's nothing else, I mean, I don't think he has national ambitions, but there's no question that the 2014 Connecticut gubernatorial race is now going to be seen as a national campaign, just like in Texas with Wendy Davis and Ted Nugent and all that stuff. Texas has suddenly become the race between Wendy Davis and Greg Abbott is now national. The Malloy reelection campaign has national significance.
A last thing for you, Ken, but before I let you go, you talked a little bit about the politics around the minimum wage. I mean, yes, of course, this is a partisan issue, but it's also something that's seen by many, many Americans, as you cited the poll numbers earlier, as being an issue of fairness. Given the fact that this seems to be yet another fight that President Obama wants to take on, that may not necessarily go anywhere. I mean, what do you see as the prospects for a $10.10 minimum wage coming out of this Congress or happening anytime soon?
Well, a lot of Republicans resent this, but the fact is that President Obama has said over and over again that he may have to go beyond or around Congress to get things done, and minimum wage may be the way to do it. You may have to do it state by state. We see a tremendous amount of increase in minimum wage talked about in Washington State and California and many states where there are Democratic governors, but coming out of Congress is very, very iffy, and probably the odds are not that good.
And Paz and Christine, I mean, you guys saw this week the labor secretary comes to Connecticut. In fact, using the fact that Governor Malloy has put this on the table, coming to Connecticut and using this as part of a whistle-stop tour to try to drum up support for this idea.
It was an odd whistle-stop tour. I mean, if you're truly campaigning for congressional votes to pass a federal minimum wage, Connecticut ain't the place to do it. You already have 2 safe Senate votes and 5 in the House, you know.
Yeah.
It was weird. They were preaching to the choir.
Very much preaching to the choir.
But helping, I guess you could say, Governor Malloy. I mean, it is an issue. The more attention it gets here, most people think it does go to the governor's benefit.
Ken Rudin, so what can people find in Ken Rudin politics these days? What are they going to find from the political junkie?
Well, this week's first of all, we have a podcast this week with we have a political reporter from Kansas talking about the crazy Senate primary there. We have stuff going on in Arizona regarding the anti-gay measure that Governor Jan Brewer may or may not have to veto, and she probably will veto it next couple of days. A lot of good stuff, and of course, the very famous Scuttlebutt puzzle
continues with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Always good to talk to you, Ken. Thanks so much for joining us.
John, that's the most insane statement I've ever heard.
when we come back from our break, we'll be talking about a new state senator in New Haven. We'll be talking about feds setting up shop at the state capitol, and we'll be getting to a few other issues as well. You can join us at 860-275-7266. It's The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us in studio today, Matt Dorenzo, who's group editor for Digital First Media in Connecticut. Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And as always, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, Colin McEnroe himself. What's on your show today, Colin?
We're doing a show since it's Oscar week, we're doing a show about movie remakes. So from The Fly to Heaven Can Wait to Clash of the Titans.
Well, what's your favorite movie remake, or am I going to have you give away something?
Actually, my favorite really is Heaven Can Wait, probably, which is a remake of Here Comes Mr. Jordan. But my real question is, who decided there had to be another Clash of the Titans? One of them wasn't enough.
We were just having that conversation in the newsroom yesterday. Who decided there had to be another RoboCop?
Right.
I'm just not sure that had to happen. So that's coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. So yesterday, New Haven residents headed to the polls. I'm not sure in huge numbers, but to elect Mayor Tony Harp's replacement in the state Senate, and they elected State Representative Gary Holder Winfield. This is not a big surprise. Gary Holder Winfield's a very popular guy as a state representative. He had been in the race for mayor himself. But, Colin, one of the things that we saw in this was a really ugly, strange campaign for something that was about a 50-point win for Gary Holder Winfield.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talk about campaigns getting into the toilets. Well, this one, literally got into the toilets. A lot of the campaigning from his opponent had to do with who's allowed in which toilet. And so, I mean, first of all, to be an African-American Republican running in New Haven, I don't even know what that's like. You know, I mean, probably is a pretty complicated thing to do. There aren't a lot of Republican candidates at all in New Haven. But one of the ads actually made it seem as though Gary Holder Winfield was in favor of just men being able to go in and use women's toilets. I mean, just willy-nilly, which struck me as kind of a distortion.
That issue actually polled well for Gary in New Haven.
Yeah, that's right.
The mailer didn't just say men. It said sexual predators will be in girls' rooms.
Well, there was that one, too. But there was one that just made it sound he's opening up the women's rooms.
It had a picture of a sad-looking 8-year-old girl who just saw his vote or something. I don't know.
It's the strangest thing. And, again, the Republican that Colin's talking about, Stephen Mullins, running this race and again, running these ads at this point, maybe it doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it seemed like a kind of a new sort of floor for the type of campaign ads we might see in a local election.
So this race is interesting. Or a couple of things. First of all, it's Obama won this this Senate district by 90 to 10%. So it was the second. You could say it's the second most Democratic district in the whole state. Gary won some precincts in New Haven by 154-3 votes, you know, whereas Mullins won his hometown of West Haven. But the question is, Mullins qualified for public financing. So he had $70,000 in taxpayer dollars to put out really just kind of blatant lying materials. And so it leads me to question the public financing system. You know, if we were to sit there and censor or determine whether people are telling the truth or not, the courts would be tied up for decades in these political campaigns. But when public money can be used for that, and we've also weakened the rest of the campaign finance laws, so people who are getting public money can also get more money through the back door now because of the campaign finance changes that we made last year, it's worth a discussion, I think, of that system.
Well, and this leads us, I think, Colin, into a very nice segue to the next thing we want to talk about potentially the role of public financing in the thing that we saw happen at the Capitol just last week. The FBI sets up shop, taking a look into Republican a legislative leadership into this entire GOP at the state capitol. And we talked about it a little bit, and it seems, in the way that Matt just said, it may very well trace back to our public financing system.
Yeah, and I don't want to seem like I'm opposed to the public financing system, because I'm not. I think it's very important. But it really is trying to implement clean elections in Connecticut turns out to be like bringing, 50 toddlers to Pottery Barn. You know, they just start pulling stuff off the shelves, no matter what you do, no matter what rules you make. So as we look at this mail-related scandal that's nesting right now up at the state capitol, it does seem to involve mailings, and it does seem to involve larger amounts of money than would have been present in a lot of these elections. So the price of getting some of the kind of private money, some of the sort of influence peddling kind of money out of the elections are these pretty large public grants. Suddenly a race that would have been, in some cases you have a candidate who's an overwhelmingly unbalanced district, where there's like a 5-to-1 registration disadvantage. So, and that candidate would not be able to raise a whole lot of money to run against an incumbent. Suddenly that candidate, if it's a Senate race this year, that candidate will, forget about the primary, which is also a large grant. The general election grant for a state Senate race will be $94,690. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for this kind of race, and it's got to go somewhere. And it turns out that there are people who are sitting there waiting to tell you where it ought to go. And that seems to be what's happening. This seems to be – we don't really know the exact nut of this FBI investigation, but it seems to have something to do with that.
Well, and Paz, maybe you can just take us through this a little bit for people who have not been following this very closely. What exactly do we know about what the feds are looking at the state capitol right now?
We know that George Gallo, who until last Thursday at midnight was the chief of staff for the House Republicans, is the only identified target or person of interest at this point. He's the only individual named in the subpoenas that were served on the legislature. And what it appears they're looking at is what role he played in arranging for this big Florida direct mail company to match them up with legislative candidates. Every caucus has a guy or a woman who is the political strategist who off the clock is in charge of recruiting candidates, advising candidates, and helping particularly first-time candidates. And given that Republicans are the minority, there are a lot of first-time Republicans. Excuse me. To set them up. Here's a package. So it's not a crazy thing. Now, the issue here is George Gallo also had a political consulting company. It apparently, I'm told by one source who has certainly knowledge of the investigation, that it did business also with the direct mail company. So the question is, were there kickbacks coming back to Gallo? Another interesting question, though, is even if there were, what law was broken? There's a lot of lawyers who are scratching their heads on that one, which is kind of a side issue to this discussion.
Well, Christine, first of all, this idea that a state employee, somebody who's working with the legislature, mm-hmm. would have a side political consulting business, this some people may say, oh, my God, that's strange. That's, I assume, par for the course?
It is par for the course. It's called the Incumbency Protection Program. and this does happen, like Mark said, with both caucuses. There are people who work for the legislature during the day and then off the clock at night they are doing the political consulting business.
The thing that was a little different about Gallo is it's unclear who else had an actual consulting business. Now, one of the twists to this, and we posted a story this morning about this, there is no requirement for legislative employees to file the financial disclosure statements that senior people in the executive branch have to file or the legislators themselves. So you cannot go over to the Office of State Ethics and say, give me Mr. Gallo's financial disclosure form and see what outside income he had. There is no reporting requirement. It's kind of a missed opportunity, and we'll see if the legislature tightens what I think is a pretty sizable hole in the ethics law.
Matt,
so this sounds familiar, right? Former House Speaker Chris Donovan's senior staff working for campaigns at one point, going back and forth to the staff, and more troubling in that case, trying to influence legislation based on who was giving them campaign cash. And so we see that in that office, and we see it in the minority leader Larry Caffaro's office with Gallo. And we see no one proposing any kind of tightening of the system or reforms or a way to prevent this.
The Democrats have been silent on this. Yeah. I mean, because they know.
Right, yeah. I think Colin said in the past, mutual assured destruction, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's that much of a mystery. We don't know what laws might have been broken because we really don't know all of the facts that the FBI has collected. But it seems to me that, you know, intuitively, this man was a state employee on the one hand. On the other hand, he has a private concern where he's directing the flow of what is taxpayer money. I mean, if most of the money we're talking about turns out to be from the Citizens Election Program, he's directing the flow of taxpayer money in certain directions and taking a cut of it. If that turns out to be the fact pattern there, I'm pretty sure the federal government can figure out a way to construct that.
What's interesting is that it's a state campaign.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
it seems as though it would be a
public tax
violation.
Dollars.
Yeah.
So why are the federal government involved?
Well, not the first time the federal government has gotten involved in what are essentially state violations, though.
And once the grant money is cashed and it's in the campaign account, I mean, it's not exactly analogous to rigging a state contract where the state. So it is this odd. It really is this odd situation. And I've talked to a number of criminal defense lawyers who say, you know, it certainly doesn't look good. It probably isn't good in an ethical sense, but I'm not 100% sure what the crime would be.
Although one thing we can say is that typically when the federal government gets to this stage, when they show up and they start going through your boxes and stuff like that, they're not at the beginning of an investigation. They're near the end of an investigation. They know what they're looking for. I mean, typically anyway, they know what they're looking for. They've already developed, you know, a working theory of the case and they've already collected it.
Although they did grab a whole bunch of stuff looking at another aspect of the Donovan case, which was a pool of bond funds that was set up for these community health clinics, and one of these clinic chains had given heavily to Chris Donovan's congressional campaign. I will hasten to say they did so legally and not using straw donors. And the feds looked at every scrap of paper on that, and they interviewed people, and that ended without any action being taken. So it does happen.
One of the things that I just found interesting when you were talking, Matt, is this idea of influence peddling, if it at all we're talking about an attempt to influence legislation, yes, the Democrats may be silent. Why on earth would you take money to the minority party at the state capitol and try to get anything done? It doesn't seem as though there's any chance to influence almost anything at all.
Well, right. And this particular scandal doesn't seem to be about that. It just seems to be it seems to be about personal gain.
But as you said before, there was money around the Donovan case that was potentially given to Larry Caffaro. It almost takes that piece of it out of the equation.
And we've written about this a lot. Yeah. Is that's why I think that the battle is not, and this is why they don't talk about it, the battle's not over campaign finance, which you can always manipulate. You can always find a way to grease some skids. It's about how legislation comes to the floor. So if the minority leader has any influence over what's voted on and what isn't voted on, that's power. And that was the case with Dunneman. They just didn't want a bill to show up.
In the last week of a session, Larry Caffaro or John McKinney, the two minority leaders, are as powerful as anybody in the building.
We're talking on the Wheelhouse today with our roundtable of panelists about the week's news. Matt Dorenzo from Digital First Media, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe from WNPR. We'll take your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. Christine, you're writing about something else that I wanted to ask you about. A contractor on the list of banned state campaign contributors gave $10,000 to the Connecticut Democratic Party, has rewritten the check to its federal account. The guy's name is John Fish. Tell us more about the story.
Yeah, so John Fish is the head of Suffolk Construction Company, and they've built 360 State Street in New Haven. They are working on the Lawrence and Memorial Cancer Center in New London. And he had given money to $10,000 to the state Democratic Party's state account. That money had to be refunded because he was on a banned list of state contractors. State contractors cannot give to the party's state account. He turned around and rewrote that check the next month to the party's federal account, which pays for the administration and federal campaigns.
You get on that list if you are pre-qualified to do work, because I'm not sure.
I'm not sure he has a state project.
No, I don't think he does.
State contract at the moment.
He's certainly been.
If he had
no
a state
payment.
Project, he wouldn't have to give him all that money.
Yeah.
but I mean, this was kind of a small but important example because it was in your face. It was like, oh, I can't put it in this pot of money. I'll put it in this pot of money, and that's been the larger issue this campaign with the federal versus the state. state.
And can that federal account, there's been dispute over, you know, whether that federal account can give money back to then the national party, which then can funnel the money back to the state party.
Well, and I think
so
just,
it's like three-card Monty.
And just to close the loop on this, I mean, with Ken Rudin, we were talking before about, you know, Governor Malloy trying, obviously, to make money at the local and the national level for his reelection. And, of course, all Democrats in the state looking to do that well. Do you think, Colin, we're going to start to see a series of these sorts of stories about, you know, who Governor Malloy is campaigning with, where the Democratic Party is getting its money, who's contributing? Are they big state contractors or politically connected people? Is this the trend that we're going to see over the course of the next couple months?
I think we already see it. And you know, I think it's been going on for months. And I think in somewhat stark contrast to 4 years ago, when Governor Malloy's campaign was something anyway of a model, an occasionally flawed model, of how to roll out one of these public finance campaigns, I think this campaign is going to be just drenched in money from a wide variety of sources. The systemic changes they wrought on Connecticut elections law one legislative session ago has opened up some apertures through which money can flow. Yeah, I just think you're going to see a lot of this, and part of the job of covering this campaign for people like the people sitting in the studio is going to be figuring out where all that money is coming from and where it's going.
And there's, you know, somebody like John Fish, I mean, this is interesting because, again, it was his check wasn't good in one account, it was for another. But the stuff that I think is potentially more troubling is you have some people getting assistance from the state. You know, there's a guy named Mark Summers in Florida. He's a project manager for Bridgeport Landing. So the day before the bond commission in September approves, I think it was $30 million to land his key tenant, Bass Pro Shops in Bridgeport, the day before the bond commission does that, he writes a check for $10,000 to the Connecticut Democratic Party. Now, the Connecticut Democratic Party, Governor Malloy, all these people say, well, it's all about transparency. You try to get the Democratic Party to say how they came to solicit that guy on that day. Good luck.
Mm. But before we take our break, Paz, I just want you to talk for a moment. You wrote about the death of Representative Elaine O'Brien after a long fight with brain cancer. She represented Windsor, East Granby, and Suffield in the legislature. Just give me a quick thought on who she was.
I will tell you, I did not know Elaine O'Brien very well. She was only there two terms. She was kind of a quiet woman. And as is often the case, when you talk to people about someone after they're dead and you find these interesting things. I mean, she was, as a teenager, she got a pilot's license. She was actually an airline commuter airline pilot for a while. I don't think there were too many people at the legislature. Maybe you did. You live in Windsor. That was part.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she part of covered my district.
Yeah.
So, but she was an interesting local official, too. I mean, for 16 years, she was the town clerk in Suffield. So there was this funny story that her friend told that she, you know, they used to call her Princess because she used to go up to Hartford for, you know, the past 4 years. So she was the big shot. And so every time her name was in a news story, she used to sign it Princess and leave it for the clerks in Suffield.
Oh, very nice. Well, rest in peace, Elaine O'Brien. When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking about something that, well, we love to talk about here. Last week during the Wheelhouse, we had so much to talk about. And then they sort of went and screwed things up and started talking about Keno right after we got off the air. So Colin McNamara will get another chance to play with Keno coming up in just a few minutes. We're talking with Colin McNamara, Mark Pazniokas, Christine Stewart, Matt DiRenzo, and with you here on The Wheelhouse and Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, so you're going to be the ambassador to, say, Iceland. Wouldn't it be great if you'd been there or you spoke the language or you knew the customs or really anything about the place? Well, the Obama administration seems to think you might be better qualified as a big political donor. We'll talk with current and former diplomats about what actually goes into the job. What skills do you need? Should political appointees be allowed to take these positions? We'll also talk with Jim Himes about his recent trip to North Africa. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us, as always, is Colin McNamara, the host of The Colin McNamara Show on WNPR, Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Matt DiRenzo, who's group editor for Digital First Media in Connecticut. Now, just after last week's edition of The Wheelhouse, which we did from a remote location in Hartford, legislative leaders came out in support of repealing something that's been widely criticized, Keno. Now, Colin, you've spoken to people throughout state government about this, and it seems as though, you know, Keno might be about ready to go away, but now nobody seems to say that they liked it in the first place. It's a very, very odd story.
Yeah, it's in the deeply unfunny cartoon Family Circus. There used to be a little character called Not Me, which was, you know, the children trying to explain how they hadn't broken the lamp. And it's sort of like that. It turns out that all of the people who might have been obvious candidates for the author of the Aquino bill are really kind of grossed out by Aquino, whether it's Don Williams in the Senate or Brendan Sharkey in the House. And Governor Malloy in particular was professing this kind of agnosticism about Aquino, that he didn't really know why the legislator did it. He didn't, you know, he didn't know whether it was good or bad. He couldn't really tell, but it really didn't have anything to do with him. And I did really press the administration a little bit about this. I went back and looked at transcripts from Pat Widlitz, the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Chairman, talking on the night of the passage, and she seemed to make it clear that the administration was involved at that point, and that there were already negotiations going on with the tribes. And it really did seem as though this was the case. I won't say that he said a falsehood, but it seemed as though Governor Malloy was certainly overplaying the hand of his innocence and lack of involvement in the passage of Aquino. His budget chairman, his budget chief, Ben Barnes, seems to have been intimately involved at the time that Aquino was making its way into the budget.
Okay. Well, Paz, you and Christine were there in those waning minutes as we were trying to figure out what all people were passing and not. I mean, what do we know is the reality of who was in support of Aquino? Who knew what when?
I'll give you the simple version. The administration stuck it in the budget bill. I mean, and you know, it wasn't the biggest deal because it wasn't a lot of dollars. And now, you know, there's some pushback. The budget's a little bit flusher than it was a year ago. This does not poll well. It never has polled well. So, you know, I just think they're all punting on it. I think as we're sliding, you know, towards Lent, you know, the cock has crowed three times for Aquino. You know, everyone's denying it.
Oh, boy.
Christine?
Yeah, no, you know, it was the usual suspects who were in the room, you know. It was the people who negotiate the budget. So it was the chairs of finance, the chairs of appropriations, the Speaker of the House, the Senate president, and the administration and the people who are part of that administration were in the room. And they had basically just killed in caucus. They had killed the Malloy's proposal to sell off electricity rates. Or electricity customers' bills to the highest bidder. So they had killed that proposal, and they had to find money somewhere. And somebody came up with the idea of Aquino, and it seems to be mutual amongst all those people in the room.
And the idea of how much money we were going to make, something like $30 million in a year. It's not like
it was over 2 years.
It was over the course of 2 years.
Yeah.
Not very much money, right. Certainly. And then as Colin asked a number of times, we weren't sure where it was going to be, how many licenses, who was going to get these licenses. Are we done with Aquino, Matt? Or?
Well, I think to pretend that there was not a lobbyist involved in someone making a deal and that just came out of the blue, we have a great idea, Aquino, I think is ridiculous. And at the time, then Senator Tony Harp, now New Haven mayor, defended Aquino and the idea of it and stuff like that. I have a feeling it originated somewhere from the New Haven Bridgeport realm of the world.
Been around. I mean, yeah, Governor Rell, you know. Yeah. Floated the idea right. For a while. I mean, Aquino is one of those things that at the end of a budget negotiation where you're looking for that last 5 to 10 million, Aquino is always sitting on the table. And somebody says, do we plug it in this year? You know, I'm not sure it took more than that. I think, there's certainly lobbying interest.
Yeah.
And this year's Aquino will be video slots.
Right.
So there is no vehicle right now. There's no bill for video slots. But, you know, New Haven, Bridgeport, Windsor Locks really want video slots.
One thing I noticed in sort of a Kremlinological parsing of some of the statements that were made was that this time around, particularly Brendan Sharkey, the Speaker of the House, did not want to be left holding the bag without Malloy on this. If you notice what he said every time he spoke about it, he mentioned the administration pretty much at the same moment where somewhere across town the administration was basically saying the executive branch was basically saying it wasn't involved or implying that it wasn't involved. And Sharkey was not going to let them get away with it this time.
And remember, there was no up and down vote in the legislature on a Aquino bill. It was tucked into the budget. And when you're voting for a budget as a legislator, you vote for a lot of stuff that you don't like. And the stuff you like, stuff you don't. And that's how you can do controversial things. You have it part of a huge package of something.
But I just want to get back to Christine's point. So video slots now, this is maybe the next thing on the table, the keynote of 2014?
Yes, this is the keynote of 2014. So you had the task force that was making the recommendations regarding video slots. They kind of were lukewarm about it, but they adopted these recommendations, and they have not turned into legislation yet. And so I think in order to not have break the compact or the tribal agreement, they are going to try at some point in the legislative session to slip in language for video slots somewhere.
But then this opens up another negotiation with the tribes. If there's a negotiation with the tribes over Keno, there's I assume a pretty dicey negotiation with the tribes over video slots.
Yeah, right, and that's why they're trying to – yeah, that's why they're trying to avoid that.
Yeah. So there's a few more things that we want to get to before we run out of time. One thing that I know that you have on CT News Junkie right now, Christine, municipal governments trying again to reduce the amount of information towns must pay to print in newspapers this year with the support of House Speaker Brendan Sharkey. This has been an interesting little fight. Can you just explain this to people?
So in order to print a legal notice, the towns are forced to print their legal notices in newspapers. And the newspapers, they say it's an unfunded mandate because why can't we put our legal notice up on our own website? But people don't check municipal websites, let's face it.
You don't check municipal websites all the time? Really?
So there's sort of a compromise, you know, put an abbreviated version in the newspaper and put a longer version somewhere online. But the Newspaper Association is upset with this because it does cut into the amount of money that they would get for these legal notices.
Okay, so Matt, you're in the newspaper business. Tell us a little bit about this, because it sounds to an awful lot of people. And look, I want to support newspapers all over the place, but it kind of sounds like the newspapers are asking for money that probably they don't need to make from the towns in this particular world of 2014. Am I right or am I wrong?
Oh, we need all the money we can get.
certainly from the town of Windsor.
But the argument
Lord
would be,
knows.
The argument would be what Christine just said. If they're going to put a fish processing plant in my town and I'm out within the 1 mile area where they have to mail me something, I'm expected to know that's happening and to check the website on the right day to like find out.
How many people read legal ads? Seriously? I mean, there's that. You know, it's really a reporter looking at the legal ads and finding out, hey, look what they're trying to do.
You know, I think if, to be honest, if someone came forward with in this day and age, the use of technology to better notify people, great. I don't see anyone coming forward with that.
That's true.
Well, and I guess so, Colin, I mean, is there a better technology to inform people about this sort of thing? There's a lot of different ways in which people get information out. It used to be that people would listen to the radio, and if you didn't listen to the radio, you wouldn't know that a tornado was coming. Now you can get an alert on your phone. There's a lot of different ways that you can let people know about what's going on in the world. Do we really still need to be subsidizing newspapers with town money in order to print these legal notices?
Well, of course, I have a small dog in this fight. I mean, I still do write for one newspaper. I think maybe one of the questions, one of the good things that could come out of this would be a significant debate about like who does have digital access right now and who doesn't. I mean, is it an ironclad assumption that anybody who ever needed to know about something would be online, if in fact you're going to make that an article of democracy, the assumption that everybody has internet access, that's a pretty good argument once again for continuing to or starting to heavily regulate the providers of internet access.
Yeah, let's municipalize ISPs. I don't hear people talking about that.
But I guess the next argument is that in order to get this notice in a printed newspaper, I mean, you have to pay money for it. It's not like it's coming out to you free and appearing on your door for free. There's still a barrier to entry there.
True. I mean, there's obviously. Well, the money that has to be paid usually has to be paid not by the consumer of the information, but by the provider of the information, presumably has a little bit of money.
But the assumption is how many people in a certain community are subscribing to that given paper. I mean, eventually, let's face it, eventually these ads are going to go away. The question is, when?
What replaces it?
Yeah.
And what replaces it? But just get to the idea. What do you think replaces it? I mean, if we're looking forward in a couple of years or whenever this happens.
I think it gets to Colin's point about digital access. I think it's going to be a messy transition, but phone pushes, all kinds of possibility.
And Christine, I know you used to work in newspapers. Paz used to work in newspapers. You're all digital now. I mean, when you look at this fight, what do you think as you watch newspapers try to scrap for these last couple dollars?
Well, it's interesting because we're on the outside of the fight because I don't get any money from legal notices. I don't know if you guys do. CT. I think it's ctpublicnotices.org. So they do have a website that is set up. But the question
website.
Is, you know, does there need to be a third-party arbiter to put these legal notices out to make sure they go up at the right time?
Right. Because selectmen have never tried to, like, keep that low profile or keep it from people from seeing stuff that they don't
exactly.
want to see.
It would be an easier debate for the municipalities if they were all better about transparency, if they all embraced this stuff. You know, many towns are still lousy about posting agendas, about posting minutes. You know, they're not taking advantage of the web in a way that they can. You know, some towns are great at it. You can sign up for an email notification thing and you get all kinds of stuff to the point where you say, stop.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a problem right now. We have too much notification of stuff that's happening. If you want the perfect symbol of it, the task force that was considering the revamp of our freedom of information laws respective to homicide photos and stuff like that, in its first meeting failed to post appropriate notice of the fact that it was meeting. Causing the Freedom of Information Commissioner Colleen Murphy to refuse to attend it because they'd violated the FOI law to have their meeting about FOI law.
Okay, we just have a couple minutes left, Colin. There's something you really wanted to get to. I know you put it on your blog this week. Another sign that perhaps the apocalypse is upon us.
Yeah, you know, actually we have sort of good news in the paper about falling childhood obesity rates. But the big corporations that make food, they're doing everything they can to stem the tide of falling childhood obesity rates. So I'm excited to announce that starting on March 27th, Taco Bell will be offering a taco waffle breakfast taco. You have to say taco a whole bunch of times. It's a waffle taco. It's a breakfast sandwich wrapped inside a waffle with a side of syrup. I think we are looking – I mean, if this were Gibbons's decline and fall of the Roman Empire, we'd be looking at a real turning point right here.
Well, and I'll just say we have the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network here, and I'll just show other folks. This is what a picture of it looks like. This is a waffle taco for anyone who wants to know. I mean, Paz, one of the things that we always ask whenever we sit down with guests to check microphone levels, it's an old NPR trick. We say, what did you have for breakfast today? Well, I'll ask you, could you consider eating a waffle taco?
No.
It should come with a statin. You know, I mean, they should just give you the statin.
A statin on the side?
Yeah.
Generic statin. How about you, Christine? I mean, a waffle taco, is this appeal in any way, shape, or form?
No, not at all.
No, come on.
Not at all.
That's not a taco. It's a meal folded up.
Yeah. Is anything folded a taco?
Well, is that
right,
I mean,
exactly.
But that might be, I think that's the nature of the taco. It's that if you take anything and you fold it around meat.
I'm excited that McDonald's is thinking about extending its breakfast hours to 10:30. That's, I think, the bigger news.
Also, Burger King is testing a chicken and waffle sandwich. So we're living in a time of waffleization.
I also say quickly, when you talk about the falling childhood obesity rates, very important. This may be one trend going in the other direction, Colin. We've also been hearing Subway sandwiches has been trying for years to try to get people to eat them because they're a healthy choice. You have a guy who lost a lot of weight selling Subway sandwiches. You have a lot of professional athletes selling Subway sandwiches. They've got a new sandwich out now that puts Cheetos on it on top. It seems as though as soon as we hear good news about childhood obesity, people are just running in the opposite direction. We've got to get fat again.
Also, I think Jared is running for Connecticut State Senate, but that hasn't been announced yet.
I think the taco waffle is fine as long as in 100 point type, the calorie count is right next to the price. On the menu.
It may be.
There are actually shockingly some salads out there that have a ton of calories. I can name one of them at Chili's.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'll just say maybe even us talking about it, there will probably be a piece of legislation at the Capitol in Hartford having something to do with waffle tacos or having to do with calorie counts.
Diana Urban is very worried about
paging
what the meat
Senator
inside
Blumenthal.
The waffle is.
She's going to call us right now. I want to thank our guest, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR this afternoon at 1 o'clock. He'll be talking about movie remakes. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thanks.
Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Always good to see you, Paz.
I feel oddly hungry right now.
Christine Stewart, editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And Matt Dorenzo, group editor for Digital First Media in Connecticut. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.
Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, combination Pizza Hut.